You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hello, friends. Here's a very special episode of the podcast, one I've been hoping to do for quite some time. I'm joined by Bob Barnett of Captain We're Sinking, one of my best friends in this life. He is a singer, a songwriter, a performer, a history teacher, a light in this uncertain time, a wonderful human being. We both love podcasts and have talked about working together. This time we did it, and we made some tentative plans for the future, which I'm so stoked about. Hopefully we do some Bob and Tom trips. You'll hear about it in the episode. I had a great time recording this here on Wednesday, the 22nd of April, 2020. Happy Earth Day. Join us on May 6th at 6 o'clock Eastern Time over at Stage It to watch Bob play some songs from Captain We're Sinking, some of his solo stuff, talk some shit. He's going to do some songs with Kara. It's going to be fantastic. There's a link in the show notes over at futurefriday.net, so check it out if it has not gone over yet, which it should not have. But please enjoy the conversation from one friend to another. Here's Bobby Barnett. All right. You ready to roll?
Let's do it.
We're rolling. Awesome. Hey, Bob, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Hell yeah. I thought maybe we could start off by telling everybody about the time that you and I had the one of the more miserable jobs ever.
So we've talked a little bit about doing a podcast, and we have like our own podcast ideas together. And after every conversation we've ever had about it, I was like, there's no way a podcast could ever start with Tom and I that doesn't begin with that job. Cause I do also feel like our friendship started with that. Like, what was it? 2 weeks.
Yeah. It was 2 weeks.
Yeah. So like, you know, I knew you as Mike's brother and like we would hang out and stuff like that. But this was the first time like you and I kind of just one-on-one were hanging out. So I feel like this is a very good place to start.
Yeah, it was perfect. I'm not sure if we had moved to Philadelphia yet or not at the time. I think that we did.
It was
right before that.
Because was it for your first tour?
Yeah.
It was like leading up to your first tour or second tour or something like that.
Yeah, it may have been it was either like, you know, maybe been a year before we moved to Philadelphia or the year we moved to Philadelphia. I forget exactly. Yeah. But so, yeah, exactly. We had known each other. I knew you as Greg's brother. You knew me as Mike's brother. Yeah. We had hung out before cursory, you know, in a cursory situation. But Greg was like, hey, you can go and stay at my mom's house, work with my brother at this job, make some money before the tour because, you know, we were in between tour. I was having some problems with cash. We couldn't figure it out. So we go up there, stay with you, and we get this job landscaping together.
And the funny thing is, too, it's not like that was like my summer job where I was like working there. Like I started day one when you started.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I stopped when you stopped. It wasn't like I was going on tour with you.
No, this like, was a, this is a, an awesome family friendship, help each other out situation.
So my neighbor in the house that we grew up in owns a landscaping construction company. And he always would tell my mom if the boys ever need work, they can, you know, I can get them doing little odd jobs. So I think if I remember correct, like Greg was talking to my mom about getting you a job to work there. And I was like, I'll do it too. I don't know why Greg didn't want to. But I was like, yeah, sure. I'll do it as well.
I have an idea why Greg didn't want to.
Because he can't. I was just about to start talking some.
We can talk some shit on Greg. I think part of it though is that because he knew that the job's gonna suck.
He does have pretty good insight when the things are gonna be pretty bad.
I think he saw that coming. This was probably this was 2007 maybe or 2008. And the job wasn't landscaping as much. It was we walked around picking up sticks out of gravel for 7 or 8 hours a day with a bunch of guys that were, you know, they were Hamlin folk. We call them Hamlin folk or Lake Ariel folk.
In the kindest of ways.
Yeah, they're Pennsylvania folk. And one of them, every time that we drove past one of the bars that's up there, he'd be like, hey, you know, I can't go back there. Can't go back there.
And if you could think of Hamlin as a town with maybe like 3 stop signs, there's not that many, you know. There's three bars that he's probably not allowed into.
Yeah.
And it's the bars in the town.
Yeah, he was one of the – that guy was one of the people that they would write country songs about. You know, he's the guy who's not allowed in any of the bars, that kind of deal.
I remember he would drive us around in the truck and then sometimes would drop us off at a house. And then he would go do something. And it was just you and I in like someone's lake house, like summer home backyard. And we would just walk and pick up sticks.
Yeah, we were getting paid between $6 to $8 an hour. I'm saying the eight. I'm pretty sure it was like $6 an hour.
I don't think it was touching eight.
That was the thing. So all the driveways were made out of gravel. They weren't paved fully. And the whole thing was to just like – they just made up work. They were just like, okay, go pick up the sticks. If you had any type of tool, any rake, any type of anything, it would have made it easier. No, we just picked up the sticks. They wouldn't even – after a couple of days, I think we realized that they wouldn't be able to tell whether or not we had done anything. So it kind of, you know, spiraled into that. I think – but at nighttime, when we got back to your house, we would play songs and work on stuff, and it was really cool.
Yeah.
And we had that cover. We did a cover on that Hardware 8-track, like a Fostex 8-track of Where's My Mind, and it was by the Pixies. And it was so fucking cool. It was still – in my mind would be the white whale.
We had like – I know. We had this like really hard day of picking up sticks, and you and I going – like we had a little band room in our basement of our mom's house. And you and I just played Where's My Mind for like 8 minutes straight.
Yeah.
Like every instrument we could find in there, we had these like little ska reggae like rack toms that we were banging on.
Like roto toms.
We
made this detuning one of the toms that was in there, and we had this, and for some reason, because of like, you know, one of those happy accidents of not understanding the equipment and the microphones and all that shit, it sounded awesome. It was like really cool.
It's honestly like one of those things. If I heard it back now, I kind of almost don't want to hear it back now, because in my mind, it's just such a wonderful, beautiful cover.
It's gonna live as a legend for me for sure.
Yeah,
it disappeared into the ether just like The Job did for me, which is a pretty funny way that it ended. I don't remember exactly what happened, but I couldn't go in one of the days. We were like working on, it was a band thing, or I had to go do something for my family back in Scranton. But I called the owner and I was like, hey, you know, or I left him a message. I was like, hey, it's Tom May. I can't come. Whatever was going on, like, I'm not gonna be able to make it that day. And then he calls back and leaves a voicemail that is like ripping me to shreds, screaming at me. And I was like, fuck, oh my God, dude, I fucked up Bobby and Greg and their mom's relationship with their next door neighbor. Like, I got fired from this job. This is so embarrassing. It sucks. And it turns out that the guy had mistaken me for Tom A, some person who wronged him, someone who really fucked his, like, you know, threw him for through a loop. Not Tom May, and that was
This guy that's been working for him for 5 days. Like, doesn't even know he exists on the job site. Like, the many jobs he has during the day, he's definitely not thinking about us picking up the twigs in some guy's yard.
Yeah, no, he thought I was this guy that like clearly had wronged him severely.
Took
the time to scream at me. And
that's such like a landmark 2 weeks in my brain, because not only was I always look at it as like the establishment of our friendship, but also I remember during that time I was kind of like right out of high school, kind of doing the, you know, our band really started kind of doing stuff around that time, but we weren't yet at the point of like where we're thinking about seriously going on tour or anything like that, or we were doing like home recordings and stuff like that. So I just didn't really know any sort of path that I was supposed to be on. And I didn't really have anyone to talk about it with. Like, all my friends were kind of like, you know, we're out of high school, let's party and have fun, and who cares about anything like that. And I remember we got the job, and it was like the first day, my mom made us two sandwiches. And we would eat those two sandwiches at like 10 a.m. because, you know, we already got bored.
Already been picking up sticks for like 4 hours at that point.
And I remember you would sit down with me and you would just like ask me like deep, heartfelt questions. And like we would like really get into it. And I remember like working those days and being like, man, this feels really good right now. Like, I'm like able to actually like talk to someone about this. I just went through like a terrible breakup, like my high school breakup at the time. I had no one to talk to about it. And you were just like, oh, like, talk to me about it.
Yeah.
And we would just sit there outside with no one around eating sandwiches in like some stranger's backyard. And I would like open up about all this stuff. And it was so nice.
Yeah, dude. That was
amazing. I never got to thank you for that 2 week.
Hell, man. Hell yeah. Thank you. that was a perfect stars aligned kind of situation. And it's a funny thing that we were just sitting on like, you know, some rich person's driveway while we were picking up their sticks and talking about our life in the future. Well, fucking, I didn't even remember that wild ass dude's name.
It's neither do I. As you said, like we drove around other people. I honestly forgot about them. Yeah. Like, oh yeah, I remember him now.
I just remember he had a hat on that was so dirty and fit so closely to his head. I was like, how could you?
The leaf blower backpacks we would sometimes get.
Yep. The privilege to use the leaf blower backpack. Oh yeah. But now here we are. You find yourselves a couple blocks away in South Philadelphia, but we can't hang out.
Nope.
It is currently April 22nd. We've experienced a couple of wild ass weird weeks.
It's truly. They put up a giant billboard now going down Front Street, like heading south, and it's just a social distancing billboard. Okay. And you go into the grocery store and they have like that automated voice over, keep 6 feet apart or keep 6 feet away from each other. Practice social distancing. You're like, wow, I cannot believe this is what everyone's doing right now.
Yeah, the evolution has been intense, especially where we are, where we're kind of piled on top of each other. And seeing the uncertainty and the we can go a million directions with this, but the way that it's changed in our world, where, like, you and I go to the same grocery stores, we see the same people, we have the same social circle. To watch the change has been a wild ride. To see the uncertainty in people that you're seeing on the street, even like the drastic changes in the grocery store. I think we've been joking about, we'll go have a routine set. You go once a week, or you go once every 2 weeks, or you didn't go for a while. I know you found yourself in a unique position where you were not meant to leave the house at all for quite some time.
Ours started off with my wife worked at an urgent care. And I got the call that someone came in, tested positive. So we went into quarantine pretty early, like beginning of March, 2 weeks shut down.
Yeah, believe you guys went in the day that we got back from Australia, which was March 10th.
Yeah. So we
I'm sorry. No, that was when we left for Australia. It was like it was later when we got back. My best.
Yeah, I think actually, because I remember talking to Greg about it, and he was still in Australia, but he said he was coming home soon. Yeah. And I think we were already like 2 days in at that point. And we got like as much stuff. I was talking – Greg is the one that made me panic buy 230 racks of PBR because he's like, you got to buy your alcohol. What are you going to do? The liquor stores are going to shut down. God damn it. And I'm like, holy – shit, you're right. And I went on GoPuff.
For those of you guys don't know, Bob and Greg and I and our brothers and some friends are in a group chat, and it came to light that the Barnetts had stocked up on like 60 warm PBRs. And every once in a while, there's a quarantine beer picture that comes in. It's pretty great.
I got two 30 racks of PBR. Greg got three. And the funny thing about it is that, like, he'll have, like, maybe he'll send a picture of, like, him drinking one.
Yeah.
But he's always drinking something else in the picture. So, like, he's stocked up probably, I would have to say, 4 or 5 times since the emergency PBR run.
Yeah.
So he's just got
– I mean, it's still the emergency PBR run. I wonder if he'll drink – I wonder if they expire because – I don't know. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I'm not going to drink – 90 PBRs for the rest of my life. I don't think there's going to be
that. I kind of just like the security of knowing that it's in my laundry room.
Totally. Yeah, I back that.
Like, it's just good knowing it's down there.
Yeah, right? Hell yeah.
So then we didn't go grocery shopping for like a while. We had everything we kind of needed, and we were stocking up early. And then I went to the grocery store for the first time, and I never spent more money. I was telling you this before we were hanging out for Mike's birthday, but like, you're kind of like going a little crazy. And it's not like I was just stocking up for the sake of stocking up, like, buying another 30 things of toilet paper, even though I already have 20. Like, we were just literally out of everything.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, like, my shopping cart was overflowing, and people in there are looking at me like I'm crazy, living in a crazy time. Yeah. Like, oh, cool. I'm the crazy person in the grocery store during a pandemic right now with the amount of food I'm buying. But I didn't buy like crazy stuff. I didn't buy like 30 pounds of marshmallows. Like I bought some normal stuff.
Or the hoarding behavior of people, just bought as much toilet paper as they could because they saw other people do it.
Yeah.
That one. Yeah, you guys, we felt really bad. You know, it was really scary to know that you guys were stuck at home. There was still, I mean, it's not like there's anything certain now, but there was so much uncertainty at that point that we were like, holy shit, Bob and Kara and the baby can't leave the house. You know, it was really
the first like 2 weeks of it, because every morning you would wake up and there'd just be a new development. And so you literally don't know what the next, because that's what, like, before the state shut down, that's when schools were still open and you're trying to figure out what they're going to do. So like every
single day. You should also mention that you are a teacher.
Yeah, I'm a teacher. Yeah, yeah. So I actually was in school when Kara gave me the call. And so I had to go to the principal and I had to go in the nurse's room, and I got like, you know, shuffled in pretty quickly into keeping on the down low of like, hey, we need to know what you know, because we need to notify the district. We need to notify the CDC of like every step along the way. So I was trying to keep them up to date on it all. But like, so, or I don't know what it's like now, but so early on in the beginning of March, it was such a mess of trying to figure out anything that I'm like, I have no news. And actually turns out that we never got news back because they weren't able to properly handle the test.
Yeah, so if you're comfortable talking about that, you guys got tested, and then the outcome was
indecisive.
Jesus Christ.
So we waited, I think it was like 14 days. No, not 14 days, it was over 14 days, because we made it to the 14 days without knowing yes or no. And we're like, well, I guess at that point, it's just we made it through the 14-day quarantine anyway. So I think it was like day 18 or day 20 or something like that. They actually called and said, they never ran the test.
Yeah, this goddamn fucking clusterfuck. Just an example of how everything's been handled.
Yeah, we're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, okay, I get it. Okay, like, cool. Like, I don't know if I'm like endangering anyone.
Again?
Yeah.
Like, no.
No? What, you mean go be around a bunch of other people who are getting tested because they were in contact with someone else? No, I'll pass that. They did turn the when you guys got tested, was it at your primary care physician, or did you guys go down to the stadiums where they had the drive through?
No, it was before that.
Yeah, before that was established.
We couldn't go to the primary care because they didn't want us in there.
Yeah.
Couldn't find an urgent care, and it actually turned out to be, I think it was Penn Medicine down in South Philly, where they became like kind of the urgent care down in South Philly that was going to do the testing. So that's where it happened, and just, I guess we'll never know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jesus. Sucks. But so you're starting to do teaching over like Zoom or from home?
Yeah, so
for the kids.
I think every school, I can only speak for my school, but
sure.
I've talked to different teachers about like what they're doing, and everything's been kind of different. I think every school is kind of implementing their own thing. Ours is fairly, you know, easy. We have like online learning packets, and then we go on Zoom. We have like office hours because we're a charter school. We don't have a lot of students in the high school. So there's only like 85 students, and each teacher has like a set 40 minutes every day of like their office hours. So if students need to check in or need help on their work, they can just sign into Zoom where I'm sitting there, and they'll just kind of say hi. No one really asks for help for work. They usually just want to say hi. Every kid misses school so much.
Yeah.
Every student I've talked to, they all just want to go back.
Damn, that's a component of that situation that I didn't even, you know, necessarily consider or think about, and that's the huge social aspect of their life at the school, you know, and just having talking to anybody.
So they'll like figure out what Zoom everyone's like all their friends are going to, and then they'll all just like pile into one Zoom and like hang out in the chat.
That's amazing.
Which is funny because you can mute them, and so like it's so funny to mute them all, and then I start
so structurally how this goes, like you're the face that they see or whatever.
Yeah, and they can turn on their camera too, but I like my students very rarely will. They'll kind of go no video, just the microphone. We'll hang out, I can mute them if I want. I learned it used to be they would be able to unmute themselves, but I figured out.
Yeah. That brings me to my next question about that, and that is that it seems like the gap, the technological gap between even your and I generation and their generation is kind of steep in the sense that it's so fully integrated into their entire lives, like they're since they were like early teenagers. So do they? That is one example that they're able to unmute themselves. That's hilarious. And I was wondering what like other parts of this technological aspect of your interaction with them is them having like an upper hand or like just a different understanding or like.
I definitely wouldn't call it an upper hand. It's just something that I've noticed. And yeah, I don't know if it goes for like all
teens. Because
they're
still kids. I mean, yeah.
All teens in the world these days. But as far as like my students go, they don't. They love to talk on FaceTime.
Ah, no shit. And like in their regular social.
Yeah, so like if they're like talking to someone, they'll just FaceTime that person. But you wouldn't have your camera up to like see your face. They will just have the camera like pointing to the ceiling and talking almost like you're speaking on speakerphone. But it's FaceTime and they're like – and the camera is just showing the ceiling.
So they did this before this?
Yeah. So like in class, I would like walk in and – someone's like talking to a friend on like FaceTime and I'll look over and then my head will just like peer over the camera of whoever they're talking to and I would like take their phone away. And I would always ask them like, why are you on FaceTime? Like, that's how we talk.
That's like, so funny.
Like, are you looking at each other? Like, no. I'm like, why don't you just call? And I don't want to. I just don't follow. So Zoom is funny too because they do the same thing.
Wow.
Because they have it on their phone. So if they put the camera on, they'll just put it up to the ceiling.
Wow.
And okay. I get so angry about it. Like, if you're going to use the camera, I want to see you. I don't care what your ceiling looks like.
Part of me is like that curmudgeon-y aspect of me where I'm like, yeah, these poor kids, they don't fully realize social cues. They're all just texting each other and not talking to each other. The fact that they bypass the talking part and actually put the camera on anyway gives me a little bit of hope. Like maybe that's like the next emotional level. Like when they get really excited, they can grab the camera and show it at them, you know, or like if they get in a fight or something. I don't know. But that's hilarious.
Yeah, to show like to show true emotion, take the camera off the ceiling and like show their face for like 1 second, then put it back on like the ceiling.
Yeah, totally.
I had five senior girls, and I like wouldn't let anyone into the Zoom because I feel really bad for the seniors, and they're just so upset because this is the way school ends for them.
Damn.
Like they've been, and especially our school, most of them started there in kindergarten.
Yeah.
And they have gone their entire life in school.
Yeah.
If you hear that buzzing, that means the dryer's done. I don't know if that came through the mic. It's hanging out by my 60 PBRs. But yeah, they've been in our school pretty much their entire life, most of these kids. And now it just like ends like this. Like, we're not going back. They don't have a prom. They don't have a graduation.
Oh, it's terrible.
This is how it ends. So I let them have like the 40 minutes just to themselves. And
oh, that's amazing.
They're going back and forth. We're talking. And most of the time it's just yelling at me. Like, they just yell at me.
What do they say?
This one girl.
You don't have to reveal what they're saying.
No, it's nothing bad. This one girl, she is such like valid. She would have been valedictorian. Such a bright kid. She is so funny because she's always yelling at me. And it's that kind of like sassy joking way, but there's like some truth sprinkled in there. So like right when I accept her in, I won't say her name out. We'll call her M. Like, M, it's so great to see you. Barnett, let me tell you what. And like starts ripping into me like she's like my grandmother. This is the first time I'm going to talk to you the whole time. You're not going to reach out to me. You're not going to say hi, ask me how I'm doing. And like starts going off. And it's so funny because like then you can always come back and say, well, obviously you didn't check your student email then last week when I sent out that email. And she goes off on this whole other thing. So then I think she brought five other kids in and they're all doing ceiling time. Is what kids – well, some kids call the FaceTime to the ceiling is ceiling time.
Ceiling time? Wow.
One student was just sitting on her bed watching TV with the camera like propped up on her dresser with just the camera watching her watch TV while like everyone else is yelling in the room.
That's the generational disconnect. That's the unboxing video. That's the thing that I see on YouTube, and I'm like, I don't know, man. I just don't.
It's so weird because I'm always just like,
love being old.
Like sitting down here in my daughter's toy room / my office / my laundry room, and I'm like, does anyone have any questions? Anything you want to go over for work, essays, things like that? No. All right, I guess you're just going to sit here for 40 minutes looking at the ceiling.
And that's just happening all over the United States right now.
That's what's happening.
Hell yeah. To jump a little bit, you're the first person that I watched on Stage It. So in this music world, to quote one of my close friends, it's getting a little kumbaya out there. At least it was at first when we first started. It's a whole lot of people jumping on the Instagram live with the acoustic guitars. But I do have to say that so I watched Jeff Rosenstock had a live show with a couple different people signing into his account when we first got back from Australia. That was super cool. I saw some friends. Yeah. Glad he played that. But yours was the first Stage It show that I went to that had like the chat next to it with everybody interacting with each other, and you're playing Captain songs, playing your songs, and it was awesome. It was fucking cool, man. And I really really enjoyed it.
It's definitely weird because I know at the beginning of it, I remember like signing into like Instagram and you'd see like everyone's like live right now, you click, it says your name is now in there. And then someone's playing an acoustic guitar, you're like, I don't know.
Phone speakers, like, yeah, not to criticize. We all want to be closer together, and that was one way to connect while we were doing it. But it was pretty funny to like hear just the worst audio of someone screaming into the into their phone. Like,
I don't know if we're there yet. This is still the like week one of like pure panic, like trying to get our bearings of what am I going to eat tomorrow? Yeah. I don't know if I'm signing in to live.
Exactly.
Right,
we ate fucking dried beans and potatoes for like 3 days before we got back from Australia. I was like, all right, Bethann, you got to go and give her like, you know, we came up with a list together. Like, all right, we got groceries. It's cool. But we need emergency groceries just in case people start acting fucking crazy.
Yeah.
I packed a bag. I was like, all right, we're in South Philly. We're right here. There's a lot of people around. People get antsy. They start acting fucking nuts. We'll escape to my brother's house, Mike. You know, we'll go to Mike's house. And so that those first couple of days were insane. And it was completely mirrored and reflected on Instagram Live.
This is so funny because Greg literally said the same thing to me. And it was probably around the same time.
Probably because him and I were saying it to each other face to face in the fucking Melbourne airport.
He was like, listen, if shit hits the fan, you know, we have the house up in Lake Ariel. You know, we go up there. You know, it's not a bad place to spend a couple months. No. We're kind of away from everything. And he's talking to me about this. And it's such a, like, you can – I'll go off on a separate side story after this one of the different dynamics my brother and I have. But like, well, he's just like speaking about this, and he's like my dad in this sense. Like, he'll just like say things and just like, you know, very kind of rationally just put things out on the board and be like, all right, well, here are like five different options. These are five things we can look at here, and like we'll assess things in time. We packed our bags that entire night. Like, everything the baby owns, everything I own, everything Carol.
Yeah, but I mean, good on you. You know, like,
we packed for 2 months, and we had everything in the living room. And that morning, we were going to get up and leave.
Wow.
And we're like, we're going to leave Philly for like 2 months, and we're going to live in Lake Ariel. Maybe Greg and Sarah will show up at some point.
Yeah.
And I remember texting him like, "All right, we're going." And he's like, "Yeah, all right, if you want to." I mean, and I'm like, "Well, you're not?" And he's like, "No, I mean, I don't know. If things get really bad, then like, yeah, maybe." So, like, the whole next day, Karen and I spent just like unpacking everything because I like, I don't know if we should go now. I kind of don't want to.
Yeah.
And so when we were kids, I remember my dad told me this. My dad would play like kind of like emotional social experiments on Greg and I's personality. And one of them was he brought us to a toy store and he like stopped us as we were walking and he goes, all right, you have 20 minutes. I want you to run in this toy store, and literally the one thing you pick out is yours. You could pick anything in this toy store. You only have 20 minutes. and you have to get one thing. If you run out of time, you run out of time, you don't get anything. But you can get one thing in this toy store. Go. And it was like, how are these two boys going to tackle this situation?
Yeah, they're
going to
work together. Does one of them have a watch?
I run up, and like the first thing I find, like some like shitty little like $3 like Ninja Turtle. I'm like, here, I'm done. My dad's like, sure. Like, you have a whole toy store here. You checked out one aisle. Like, you're done. I'm like, I'm done. That's what I want. That's it. Greg took like the entire time, like freaking out with multiple things in his hands, like freaking out about the time. I'm like, I don't know what I can get. And I feel like that kind of stays true to our
knowing you two so intimately, the both of you, that's like an incredible story. It almost sounds like a parable or made up or something. It's perfect. That's so fucking funny.
We would like my dad would always like do stuff, and I'd like have like mental like just breakdowns, freaking out. Like, we'd be walking in Manhattan where he worked, and like carrying his bags, and he would give us like, you know, three bags each to carry or something like that. And I would be just losing my mind about how much I don't want to do this task. And Greg is just kind of like silent next to him, like, it's going to get over at some point. Like, they'll be fine. And you can just see the different personalities.
Hell yeah. And seeing why you guys work so well together and do that.
So,
that was another thing. You spent so much time, especially I know at a big point in Captain We're Sinking's journey, living in Manhattan, working in Manhattan, or living in Brooklyn and working in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And it seemed like New York really shaped the venues you guys played at, the bands that you met. You know, every time that we would come and play, you'd come and be there. And it's like it was pretty cool to watch you on that journey.
Yeah. It's something I always talk. I always like talk about it too. When I have a new batch of students, is that like I was such a terrible high school student, like not behaviorally bad, but my grades were so poor. Like, I just saw my report cards. My mom still has them at her house, and I went through my report cards, and they were so bad. Like, I got out of high school.
That's so funny. You had like, you know, terrible grades, and now here you are teaching and like helping kids learn and get their great grades.
Like, all I thought about in high school was playing in a band. Like, I'm like, school doesn't matter to me because I'm going to play in a band. I'm going to tour. And I really don't care about any of these classes right now because I'm just not going to need them because I already know what I'm going to do. Get out of high school, kind of trying to figure out our way in the band. And I go to Penn State Worthington, the Scranton campus.
Represent.
Yep. And kind of treat it the same way I treated high school. And I was like, oh, wait, I can just not show up. I can just not go, and they're not going to, like, get mad about it.
Yeah, and not so this time. There's not even going to be a truant officer. There's no phone call. There's not...
And so I just, like, wouldn't go to my class, and I got kicked out, like, first year there. And I just failed everything. They're like, yeah, you're on academic probation, and we don't want you
back. Do you remember
back.
What your major was?
I definitely didn't have a major. Like, as undecided as undecided can be. I took the Bible as literature. That was one of my courses.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny. That's how actually, I can't give away the story. I was going to say that was how we got our band name, was one of the classes that we had, that I had at Penn State Worthington.
Nice.
Yeah. But.
So I like miserably failed out of there. And I remember my dad saying, like, listen, if school is not for you, we're going to figure something out for you because you're not just going to sit around. And he put the idea out there. He's like, if you move, then you got to move to New York. You work for me and we figure it out from there. And that was right after the summer, actually, of you and I working. So you and I worked that 2-week job, just like failed out of college for the first time, just went through like my high school breakup. And I was like, I got nothing going on here. So I moved to New York. Started working with my dad, and it really shaped me as a human being and just a person.
Sorry to interrupt you. What was your job with your dad? Wasn't it fucking serving people?
Yeah, that was part of my job. I would go to banks and stuff like that and serve papers. So one time I had to like serve like an individual, and it was like on Park Avenue. And the door guy like instantly knew who I was and like called up to the guy. And I sat down in the lobby for like an hour and like a little over an hour. And I'm like, this isn't happening. But it was like a lot of times just like not serving individual people where you gotta like dress up and like hide yourself, but
yeah,
you'll go
like what was that stoner movie, Pineapple Express? That was his job at the beginning. Yeah
I would have like the papers, but I was like more for like the secretary.
Yeah, somebody at the business worked. That was their job, was to take the papers. Yeah,
take the papers. And I was there was one, there was like a company party going on, and I went into the like boardroom where the party was, and I would just have like the paper, and like, and someone just took it out of my hand. I go down to City Hall and like file paper. I would go up to like the judges' chambers to like file paper and stuff like that, which is pretty cool. Cause you like go up to their office, like their chambers, and it's like,
it sounds like a pretty, you know, it's like a pretty good job for a 19-year-old kid or whatever, an 18-year-old kid. It's like, that's who you want to do that job.
And I cannot believe the patience my dad and his partner, Marty Casey, had for me, because like, I would also have to put things into a spreadsheet, but then I would get bored on the computer and I would just like read things on the computer for an entire day. And like, they knew I like wasn't, like, I found out much later on, maybe like around my wedding, when they were both there. That they would take bets some mornings whether I would show up. And I have to say, I was a terrible worker. I never missed a day.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
And I was always on time. And that's something that always kind of stuck with me too, is I've worked a lot of weird jobs. That landscaping job, worked on a golf course with your brother.
Oh yeah, I got to throw in. We weren't, you know, we had the landscaping job for 2 weeks because, you know, it was in between stuff and I got fired because I wasn't Tom A. but we, you know, where we grew up, everybody worked a lot and hard. And that was one of the best things that we took away from coming from that area, I think, was that work ethic.
I worked in the service industry, worked in a grill for like 2 weeks. I was afraid to get burned, so they put me as like behind the cash register. I worked a construction job throughout college. And like, my main thing was like, I know I'm so bad at these jobs. Yeah. Like, if you see me in person, if you know who I am as a human being, like, I would be mortified if I was coming over to a commercial site doing construction. Like, I was the guy with like a jackhammer, like in the basement, ripping up like these pipes. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing down here. But like, I would make sure to show up before everyone else got there and just be nice to everyone. Yeah. And it's hard to fire someone that's nice. That was always my motto.
So while you're doing that with your dad, you guys were practicing like, what, Squid and Leo and Zach coming up to New York, or it was like
Zach and Leo were living in the Ava house in Philly.
Yeah.
And this is when I lived at a place called 538 Johnson. And 538 Johnson was pretty cool because it was like a hallway filled with graffiti, and every loft space had like their own show going on that, like, one of the nights of the week.
Yeah,
like,
there's always
a different show going on. I saw Bridge and Tunnel there a number of times. The singer from Jawbreaker's latest band was playing across the hall one day when I came home from work, and the old drummer against me.
Literally across the hall, though. It's like,
like
10-foot walk. You get
I got home from work, and there was like a kind of an unspoken thing and like in the building of like, if you live in the building, you can go to the shows for free. So you kind of just say what apartment is yours, and you can kind of just go to everyone's shows. And I remember walking in there, I'm like, man, that guy looks familiar. And it turned out to be like one of their first shows. I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool, across the hall. And then you guys, we had that big Menzinger's Captain Lemuria show in my living room, which was great. People were jumping off the balcony we had.
Yeah, the makeshift balcony in the clearly not residentially zoned building with it was like 8 by big posts, or like 6 by 6 posts that just kind of like built the structure of the entire thing.
There was no heat in the building, but you didn't need it because the building was always just so hot.
Hell like even and shout out to everybody who was in there. Jordan, Susie,
and then we had
Taryn. So fucking great.
Yeah. That place was as wild it can be. I remember coming home from work one day, and Method Man was shooting a music video on the roof. There's like all these like wires going on the hallway, and Method Man was upstairs shooting a video.
That's so fucking funny and awesome.
Yeah.
Then you came and you lived with us for a summer.
Yeah, and then I lived in your basement. I was roommates with Joe, your drummer.
Oh yeah,
we shared the,
so many legends in the Mountain House, the Mountain Street basement. Joe lived down there. Eric lived down there. You lived down there. Colin and Leslie lived down there. Yeah.
When I was down there, it was me and Joe, and I remember you would wake up in the morning and your pillow would just be damp. Just kind of soaking wet. I'm like, this
because they kind of sealed the basement, but then they just put up they didn't do like a drywall situation with studs. They just did like plaster, and then the floor was tile, and there was a drain that somehow got pumped up with no pump system, and it just once in a while there'd be spots of water. You weren't sure how they got there. It wasn't raining.
That was like in like the glory days too, like the height, I guess, of like Ava House, because Zach and Leah were living over there, so we'd practice all the time.
Yeah, so they were only like 4 or 5 blocks away.
Yeah, like 4 blocks away, so you ride your bike over there. And I remember one night they had the stage that they used, that like big giant plank of wood that they would use for the stage, and they had it flipped over, and they had this giant D&D game going on, Dungeons and Dragons. I never played Dungeons and Dragons before, but they had like all the lights set up, and it was like this big, beautiful thing, and you would take like skateboarding breaks in that big empty room. Is just a weird existence.
Yeah, for anybody listening, Ava House was the spot that our friends had lived at. Zach and Leo lived there. Danielle, DJ, Joe, everybody, so many people lived there. We had so many shows there. And it was in an open space. Like the way it was set up was the second floor of what was essentially a garage underneath. And, you know, that also certainly was in zone residentially, I could imagine.
The floor
used to bow like a good foot down.
I remember Matt and Leo going into the garage during – maybe you guys were playing, and you would just see the floor just – bowing underneath, like this is definitely gonna
cave. Like back in the early 2000s, you'd read the stories about the frat parties that had collapsed parties and shit like that. Yeah. That was our like, you know, alt counterculture equivalent for sure. But
it's funny to think about those times. You're like, well, I guess that was like my college experience. I'm like, I don't know, we kind of did the same thing I guess you would do in college.
Exactly. It was the same thing, except ours had a lot more like that had no rules and no structure, except that you had to go to work. A lot more, insanity.
I don't think
they also had. Remember, they had Project. I forget what it was called.
Oh, with the mice.
With the mice. Yeah. So there was such a bad mouse infestation. Yeah, I think it was like Matt and all those guys and Leo. They had a whole blueprint thing set up so they could remember where the traps were, and they would log where they caught mice and how many of the mice that they caught. So that, you know, first off, they wouldn't get caught in the trap themselves or forget that the trap was there, but they would also see where they can concentrate their traps most efficiently.
They did like a D-Day sort of operation where they're like, they knew that like this night was like, this is going to be a bad night. And I remember talking to Leo about it, and they were up all night with just the sounds
just
of
waiting
mice.
For the clap of the fucking mouse traps.
Just all night long, just hearing mice die in large numbers.
Oh, yeah. I remember just like taking a piss, you turn around, and there's just a mouse. You're like, okay.
Yeah. I don't think they would have, maybe I would have to ask Danielle or Leo, and someone will correct me on this, but I don't know if they had, I don't think they had a sink. And so they would just fill up
the tub.
Like if you're going to boil water, you would fill it up with a tub.
Yeah, so you wash. Like, I remember you'd go in and the tub would have dishes in it. You'd wash the dishes in the tub, like that kind of.
Zach lived in a tent for a while.
Zach
in the
living room. Yeah, and this was not, you know, that much different than how we were. I mean, our shit worked for the most part, but you know, we had our mice. We had this BB gun that we would sit there and wait for the mice to come up and shoot them. One time I was in our roommate's room at Mountain Street, and a mouse came out, and I was hammered, and it ran to my jeans, and I started punching my jeans and got them. Flurred my jeans and the mouse fell out. And threw him in the trash can and never told him.
538 Johnson, I don't think I remember any like mice problems.
Cats.
Yeah. Good thing about living in a giant factory, I think. There's just no mice.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Send them out.
But that was a fun period of time because you would have like a show at our house in Brooklyn, and then you would take like one weekend, and then the following weekend there'd be like different house shows going on in Philly.
Yeah.
And you would take the Chinatown bus back and forth for $20 round trip.
So
and just like stay on couches or whatnot for the weekend, and there's always someone playing somewhere.
Exactly. It was like right at the end of the housing crisis, right at the beginning and middle of the housing crisis. It was like there's venues everywhere. No one can go to the bar. We weren't old enough to go to the bar, so we would just go to houses. And it was, you know, we're remembering all the good parts right now. It was definitely pretty great. I'm sure, yeah, our neighbors weren't as stoked, but.
No, I couldn't even imagine that now.
No, I couldn't.
Like, that's insanity.
Well, when's the last time you guys played a house show? I remember I went to one like 2 or 3 years ago, and I have some hot takes about it. Well, probably not hot takes, but yeah.
I think I was at the house show you went to that you have hot takes about.
The Sidekicks one?
Yes, it was, and yeah. I remember speaking to you outside.
Yeah, and I was like, these motherfucking kids who live here are like 30 years old. They're a bunch of, you know, a bunch of kids, like middle class white kids, move right into a black neighborhood and just like take advantage of the fact that nobody's going to call the cops, and you know, they acted like assholes, and it was super weird.
That was the last house show I went to. Yeah. We played a house show, I think in West Philly, not too long before we broke up, and it was actually at that point where Leo and I were talking about, like, all right, we kind of got to get like a handle on what this band is, or like what we want to be. Because of, like, I remember Leo saying, he's like, listen, if we're just going to do like house shows like this, like we've always been doing, like, all right, fine, let's just like name that and do it. But if we're going to try to do something more, then we have to name that as well. And we got to like not live in this in between, because like we would play a house show. And I think at that point in the band, we kind of had a little bit of a taste of like what a big show was like. And it's kind of, it was definitely hard to play shows like that and then go back to a house show and be like, I kind of feel.
Does the microphone work? Are we getting paid?
Like, you can never like replace that feeling of, you know, playing a house show and being like young and in the moment of it. But I think when you're out of the moment of it, and then you're going to play a house show. And I was like, man, I just feel out of my skin right now, out of my element, just not having a good time.
Yeah.
And that's like actually started the conversation of like, yeah, I don't think we're going to do this band anymore. Because we really just like, we were on so many different like paths as a band of like, this is the band we're going to be, or this is the band like we want to be. And then we will just self derail it. Like our famous saying was, I feel like we could write songs. I feel like we're a good band. We're just so bad at being a band. And we would show up to like a festival with like 10 shirts.
So that part, you mean? Yeah. Like the,
yeah. Like we were just bad at managing ourselves.
Totally. Whether you dump in a whole shit ton of money to print more shirts, or you're like, I don't know if I'm going to get it back. I don't know whose job.
But then
is what.
Like doing dumb stuff and like leaving your merch at the show. Or leaving your amps there, like, you know, showing up to a show without guitars and being like, hey, can we borrow yours? Like, just bad.
Yeah. So what kind of journey has that got you on now? Like you know, you put out the solo shit, which I fucking love. It's awesome.
Thanks.
You now are married, working as a teacher. Writing songs, making a little bit of electronic shit. Congratulations, you beautiful baby girl.
Thank you very much. Yeah, life
has... Where does that leave you now with as far as the music and shit goes, you know, like how
So my big thing, like, after the band broke up, it was like definitely tough because you don't have that outlet anymore. And at first I thought I really didn't need it, because I started teaching, moved to Philadelphia, we're getting married, I'm going to start a family. And I'm like, as long as I can play music by myself, like, I'm not going to stop playing guitar. As long as I can keep playing music by myself, record some music every now and then, put it up online, kind of let it be, then I'll be happy with it. But you also feel like a little piece of yourself goes. And that was always the thing I was afraid about with the band ending, is that, like, are you also losing a part of yourself? And, you know, I didn't realize how much a part of myself was in that band. And so actually doing the live stream last month, like, reconnected with that side for the first time since the band broke up, like playing those songs again and kind of like interacting with people who know the songs and were like genuinely enjoying themselves. It's like, oh wow, this for the, I haven't felt this in, I don't know, when we broke up, 2016 or 17 or whatnot. Like, but I haven't like felt that since then. And you realize that you kind of like lose almost, it feels like a limb maybe, just like a piece of yourself. And
I can't even imagine, man. You tell yourself, yeah, that's so, how you're identified by a lot of ways. Your whole thing is wrapped up in that. And then, you know, like, you can't just, you know, stop, you know?
It's and I think it kind of goes into like what we're talking about, like personality, like what my personality is like. Like, I'm such a hot and cold kind of person where, like, you know, I'll definitely react before thinking. And so like in my mind, it was just like, oh yeah, that's fine. I can just end the band and that'll be, and then I just don't need that anymore. Like my life's just different now. And then you get so far away from it. It's like, oh yeah, but you kind of like lost that little side of you. And I really miss that side. So the solo stuff has been great because it's been able to like find that creative outlet again. But then you realize that you're now like one single person in a giant ocean. Where in, like before it was the four of us and like, all right, we'll figure it out somehow. We always have the four of us.
Yeah.
Now it's like one person. So, all right, if I'm going to record something, I got to save up for a year and put money into a savings account to actually have some funds to go into the studio with.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to go do this. And it does lead to like some creativity, like buying the like little drum synth pad that I got and like creating electric music, like electronic music has been like a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
So you find like new avenues to do it, but definitely that playing a show, the crowd, interaction, like that part is definitely missed.
Yeah. That weird, bizarre thing that what it is essentially, it's kind of like, you know, you ever hear of a cargo cult? The cargo cults. No. So the cargo cults were, there's like a random islands in the Pacific that were used as kind of in-betweens, tactical in-betweens that the U.S. Military used. That they would go there and it would be a place they can refuel, or there'd be an airstrip there or whatever. And there'd be indigenous people on the islands. And they're like, holy shit, all these fucking giants showed up and these weird metal beasts. And they gave us all this free food and medicine and all this kind of crazy shit. And then as the war ended and they lost their reason for them to keep, like the, for reason for the military to keep coming there. Some research, I'm going to butcher this, by the way, so please do your own research. Some people came back years later, some academics and shit, and they saw that the people who had lived there had recreated like, binoculars out of tools. They made like earpiece things out of coconuts and shit.
Wow.
And they were just like emulating almost in a ritual way what was happening. Cause they thought that if they did that, then the stuff would come back again, like the people who were there that would like kind of re-emulate that shit, which I always thought was super fascinating. Because you are also a history teacher, and we do, you and I do often talk about that wild ass kind of shit.
Yeah,
shout out to Scott, History Memes Chat.
Yeah, history memes chat.
But
show my students sometimes a hot meme that comes in.
Hell yeah,
from Scott at like 2 p.m. on a Wednesday.
That's so awesome. But yeah, where I was going with that was that it's kind of like what we were doing, or what we started out doing, the live shows as, was kind of almost emulating the pop culture and big rock shows that we saw, and then turned that into like a collective experience where we're with each other. And then I was just want to ask you about the reconciliation of, like, you were saying you missed that, and now it is back into just making the music. And it's kind of like, while you're writing, what is the expectation for what the songs are going to be? Like, do you have them as, you're just going to share them with your friends, or you have them like, this is how I envision it would be, a big show, or like?
Exactly. That's the hardest part about it, is that like you go into it and like, I don't know how you are with writing songs, but when I was always doing it with Captain, it's like, all right, I'm going to picture this playing as a band.
Yeah.
And like, I'm going to picture this in a live setting.
Oh, yeah.
And
we're like, going to ramp this part up to the last chorus, and it's going to be gang vocals because everybody in the crowd is going to fucking sing along, man.
This is where the crowd's going to go crazy. And I'm going to front flip into the crowd during this time, so I don't really need to play something crazy on the guitar.
Exactly.
But even like if I write like kind of like solo, like softer kind of stuff, I still think about like what would I do with this live? And then you kind of have to, like, I kind of remind myself, like, I really don't play shows anymore. And maybe like once a year I'd play a show with like Roger at a bar in Philly.
Yeah.
But like, I just don't play shows anymore. So you have to like, you take that side of it and like, what would this look like in a show setting? You're like, well, you're really probably not going to play this in a show. And then it starts this cycle of like, oh man, well, what's the point then? Should I even like pick up this guitar anymore? Should I even still do this anymore? And then you kind of go into this long winded thing of like, oh yeah, well, you go back to like, oh, I'm just releasing online. Who gives a shit? And it's this nonstop cycle.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I can see that, man. That's like one thing I think about often while we're writing as well. We're in the same spot. We're like, what are we going to do this for? How it's going to come off live, or how people are going to accept it. And it's like, you know, a constant battle that I don't think anybody has a real good answer to.
Yeah, it's like you kind of you want to be that person that's just, I don't know, you just write a song, you put it out there in the world, and who cares? Like, songs will keep coming. Yeah. Just keep writing. You don't want to, like, think about – yeah, like, I've been sitting on – I wrote them out today. I have 30 songs.
Jesus Christ.
30 songs for, like, in the past, like, 2 years.
That's so many songs.
And they all have their own separate
project. That's more than a song a month.
Yeah, they all have their own separate project and their own separate home. I just don't have the means or resources and time to do it. So I'm just like, all right, well, now I'm going to do this. So, like, I was showing you – I went to my brother's house today and gave me this old tape recorder that's broken. Like, all right, well, I'll, like, learn how to fix that, and then I'll carve out 7 of those that can, like – kind of go into a tape recorder acoustic Nebraska style sounding thing. Then I bought this drum synth machine. I was like, all right, cool, I'll start making like these dancey type songs for some of the songs I have, and you kind of put them in homes, but then you just kind of stretch out the time as well. And so now, like, I've been sitting on these songs for 2 years now and just kind of find new homes for them and hope they find one.
Yeah, I hope they find one too. I hope I get to hear them all. Well, 30 songs. Hell yeah.
I saved up money. I saved up my own personal money. I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go into the studio. Me and Bill, Bill from Captain, and Ian from Slaughter Beach Dog and Modern Baseball, went into the studio and wrote 10 songs. And we did like a pre-production, like, this is it. We're doing it. And then life just kind of happens. Yeah. And you have a savings account of some money, and then life happens, and you're like, well, I mean, that's got to go on the back burner. And then you kind of just square one again. Like,
yeah.
Well, cool.
It's like, well, do I fix my car, or
yeah.
Do I spend a day going over guitar tones? You know? But so are you going to do another stage it soon? What do you got coming up?
Yeah, I'm going to do another stage it May 6th, Wednesday at 6 p.m. I'm going to play some old Captain songs. I'm going to do some songs from the solo albums. And Karen and I are learning some covers because we did a
jump. Oh, my God. Incredible.
A lot of fun.
That's awesome.
The babies in the background kind of raising all sorts of hell. So it was a lot of fun doing it.
I'm going to put a link to that stage. Yeah. If there one exists already, I'm going to put it right in the show notes if anyone wants to join. He said it's next Wednesday at 6 p.m.
May 6th.
May 6th. Sorry.
Yeah. So I think 2 weeks.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about asking you about when I was thinking about this podcast that we're doing right now, was, do you remember when we went and did our first Captain and Menzinger's tour out to Michigan?
Is that when you drove us?
That's when I drove you guys.
Yeah, because that show in Flint was one of the strangest times ever in my life.
Yeah, and I love talking about it with people that were there, because everyone has a little bit slightly different memory of everything that happened. What I remember was you guys hit me up. I don't know if it was you or Leo, and was basically said, we don't have a car to do this tour that we had scheduled. Which is basically out to Flint, back. You know, yeah.
Who is the mastermind that came up with that route? All right, we're going to get to Flint, and then we're going to come home.
Michigan, we're going to come home. There's a couple other shows in there. But this was the kind of crux of the whole thing, and it'll always be remembered as the Flint show. But so at the time, I brought my girlfriend's car, who happened actually was Augusta from Kaitana and Gladdy. She lent us her car. I can't believe she did that.
Lent us her car.
It was amazing to drive out to Flint, Michigan. We're going, and the biggest snowstorm hits.
Yeah.
Massive snowstorm. We get stuck in traffic for so long. 10, 12 hours, whatever it was. There's cars overturned everywhere. We're just driving in Augusta's like 1988 Oldsmobile or whatever it was, 94 Corolla or some shit.
You're handling yourself very well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was I was driving. It was you, Roberto, Leo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was just the four of us in the car, right?
And Zach.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Sorry, of course. And Zach. Yeah.
But Roberto was drumming for us. Yes.
Yeah, Roberto was playing, and we would stop every couple gas stations during that snowstorm. We stopped at a beef jerky outlet.
Yeah, which was hilarious. I have pictures on my laptop of us in the beef jerky outlet.
Yeah.
I have pictures on my laptop. I'll have to send them to you of that tour.
That's incredible. I need to see those for sure. That's like always a legend in my mind. We got
One of my favorite pictures is I was in the kitchen at the house show in Flint, and I like peeked through like a window, and there's like five guys hanging out on that like crummy looking couch, and someone just has a giant bunny hat, like a bunny stuffed bunny head on, and they're all just sitting there drinking like Paps or whatever, and then this one guy has a giant, like, totally normal conversations happening. He's not talking to anyone. I'm like, I'm really losing my mind here. Do you remember the pipe that was like oozing
septic
shit?
Yeah, so that was, as soon as we got there, there's a band playing already. Basically, we go down in the basement and the pipe had burst and there was like water, but there was also, it was sewage. It was like, you know, fecal water.
Yeah. One guy had,
one of the kids in the pit took his t-shirt and he like was swinging it around and was shooting all over everybody. I remember in that moment we were walking down the steps, someone had just gotten a smartphone and they dropped it and it smashed immediately on the steps. It was like the first week that they had the smartphone fucking cracked. We get down there, they're throwing all that shit around. A fight breaks out because that kid's throwing shit on everybody. And then all the people from Michigan were like, fuck these people from Philly or whatever, a bunch of assholes. We're going back and forth with them. But by the end of the night, everybody was really good friends until – I even forget who it was. Somebody was making out with somebody else, and then somebody threw –
oh, the stink bomb.
The stink bomb, yeah. Or the firecrackers.
Or it was the firecrackers.
I think it was firecrackers, yeah. Somebody threw firecrackers in the room.
I think Zach threw firecrackers into the room.
Yeah, and it just – the entire thing devolved into to insanity. And that was what 2009 was like.
I remember waking up on the floor. I tried to go to bed early because I literally felt like my mind was like oozing out of my ears. And
I mean, someone was.
Someone was on a chair above me, just like sitting and rocking. It was pretty early in the morning.
Oh, the meth kid.
Yeah. And he was just like, that's what, because I was going to say whatever drug it was, but he was like rocking back and forth. And I woke up and I looked at him and he's like, I got to go.
Wow,
like,
get some
more meth or whatever. And just like walked out to the snowstorm and never saw him again.
Yeah. I remember they took us to a party. It was the first time I ever went to a party store, quote unquote, in Michigan. That's what they call them. That's where you can buy like lottery tickets, chips, and liquor and beer all in the same like corner store. They call them party stores. And that was like the only thing that was open during that blizzard.
I remember taking the microphone. There wasn't a mic stand, and we like hung it over a pipe
in the basement, and then you just sang into it.
And it just dangled, and you would have to like sing near it.
Remember they would do that once in a while at the house shows, and you'd be able to take a piece of tape and you'd make a 45 degree angle kind of brace around the cable, so it would like put the microphone kind of parallel to the floor.
Oh my god,
man! We made it out though, safe and safe and sound.
It's so funny because I remember getting out there. I don't remember coming home.
Me too. I was trying to think of where we played after that. I can't fucking remember.
It wasn't Flint. It wasn't a straight shot back to Philly. It wasn't from Flint.
No. I feel like we could loop into a bunch of the Ohio shows there when we stayed with the Sidekicks.
Oh, so that's what I think it was. I think Greg got really sick.
I wonder if it had anything to do with someone throwing septic in his face.
We played, I think it was Matt Sanders' house in Lakewood.
Soggy Dog.
Yeah, and my family came out to it.
Oh my god.
Greg had like a pretty good fever and he was freaking out. He's like, you can't tell them to come here. Like, this is just like a house. Like, our aunts and uncles aren't gonna hang out at this house with us. You have to like intercept. And I remember I walked outside to smoke a cigarette and they're walking up the stoop and they have like a couple six packs.
Incredible.
And they're like, hey, Bob, so are we here? Like, yeah, so it's, just kind of house shows. Like, so like, oh, it's like a party thing? Like, sort of.
Yeah.
So like,
to us, it meant so much more. And looking back on it, it's like, that's exactly what it was. It's a party thing.
It's like, so this is just like a party thing? You're just like playing a party? Like, yeah, kind of. And they're like, so we should just – we should just go then, right? Like, yeah, you just don't want to be here. And I remember they dropped the beer up on the stoop and left.
Amazing. But we paid it back, though, because they come to see us at the crazy venues that we play over there. It's pretty great.
Yeah. Every Ohio show, they always come out in full numbers.
They do. They go hard, too. They are a bombastic bunch. I love them to death.
They're big people.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah, they're big, big Ohioan people.
Oh, yeah. So besides the stages show, what you got coming up next?
Well, I got 30 songs.
Yeah, if you're listening, Bob's got 30 songs.
I got so,
somebody
I got
put
so,
them out.
So the project right now, and this is all subject to change, is I got some of those songs are like the songs I did with Ian and Bill, and we are going to find time once this is all over to get into the studio and record those. So those will be like full band kind of Captain-esque songs, big and loud, more rock and roll-y kind of songs, but we're sounding really cool. Have another album of like electronic, like postal service kind of music, because I don't know any electronic music except for the postal
service. Except for the postal service,
so like,
hell yeah.
Every single day I've just been listening to the postal service. I have nothing else to reference.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, I think if I just kind of do this, it'll make it sound like this.
Yeah, so I backed the shit out of that. I can't fucking wait to hear that.
Yeah, so that's been kind of like, I guess if you can call it a quarantine project, like when the baby takes a nap, Carol will take a shower, and then I could come down and put some headphones on and do that, which also is like great because now I can just have a means of recording at home and releasing it online. Like,
yeah.
I've been looping in Ian with this project as well, and we'll do vocals at the studio to make sure they sound good, but like all the music will just be electronic, so we don't need like tracking or anything like that.
Yeah, I love that so much. I feel like that there's going to be a couple projects, not just yours, but some other people are going to be doing shit like that, like similar to the 2008, 2009, 2010 chill wave kind of shit that happened after kind of like, you know, stuck in their house. But I cannot fucking wait to hear what you did with it, taking like your upbringing in punk, loud rock music, and then try to translate that over into like synthesized kind of, you know, your stereotypical.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun because
so sick.
Yeah, you look at it in the mind of like, well, I still write songs the same way as I wrote songs when I was in a punk band, but now I just have like a lot of beep boops.
Yeah, kind of like David Bazan kind of shit, like rolling.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
I love that.
Yeah, and then the stage, and then I don't know. I guess the stage shows will kind of be just like, what, if people still want to do them, then we can do them.
Yeah, the biggest part about obviously the biggest part was you playing. One of my favorite parts of the stage it was to see people commenting that I know through you guys that I have not spoken with or interacted with in a long time. You start seeing some of the same names there, and you're like, holy shit.
Yeah,
you know,
cool.
That's that
like,
kid from Florida that I haven't talked to in forever is, cracking jokes about being in a live venue. You know, it's super cool. There's a really great social aspect to it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Like it kind of like cemented to me of like who, like our core group of fans were, and like they're talking about like the fest down in Florida, and we always had such a good time playing the fest, and like it's so nice interacting with these people again because we were always treated so well. By the like this core group of like fans that we had, and it's nice being able to interact with them again, and it really like sparked up that love for the band, what the band did, those songs that were written, you know, so long ago, kind of rediscovering them in a different eye, in a different lens. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, took them in a brand new context that
I definitely don't want to overstay my welcome. Don't want to get too kumbaya with it. I'm like, oh, here we go again.
Yeah.
The dude's in his basement with a guitar. But it'll kind of take it month by month, maybe do one once a month, once every 2 months, and kind of rekindle some of those old songs.
Hell yeah. I do got to say I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm really stoked to see the journey that you've been on. And I'm a little bit spoiled. I get to know you so well as a friend and see you move on your personal life and stuff, which is fucking awesome. And to see your music as it evolves is so fucking exciting. And I want to thank you so much for being here with me.
Thanks, Tom. I think it should be noted that just like how close of friends we are, I mean, I think we're in four long-running group texts with each other.
That's true. Like, I think we are. That's totally fucking true.
That's not even just like, hey, we're having a birthday party for Karen. Like, don't respond to this text.
Yeah,
Like, not those kind of group texts. Like, the ones that text every single day. I think you and I are in four.
Yeah, hell yeah. That's the one that's like, hey, this has been a milestone for me, or this is something that I want to share with another human being. That's who I'm going to share it with.
Yeah. You're one of the groomsmen at my wedding.
Oh, fuck. Which was incredible. Scranton Country Club, shout out. I thought maybe we could actually, before we wrap up, maybe talk about that a little bit. Not your wedding, which was amazing, but the fact that we do maintain a social web and a reoccurring, you know, the group text, like a social checking in with each other that I think lacks to a lot of people, specifically to a lot of like males, I think, or be more wary of like getting involved in a situation where they're sharing their feelings, or anything like that. And I just, it has been such a huge positive influence on my mental health, my physical health, my life, to be able to check in with like a group of people in the text with the set out idea of being like, hey, we're going to be here as a resource for each other for this reason. And I can't like encourage people listening to this enough to do that with your friends. You know, it's like really, it's a very valuable
asset. Especially now with like, with a good number of our friends being spread out, and you just don't see anyone as much as you would like to. It's nice to be able to that, like every single day, someone's in there talking about something that they're doing. You know, Chris is sending a picture of what he's been working on down in Florida. Carly's doing the same thing. And then you guys checking in, Mike sharing the craziest things working in PNG.
Let's don't know, my brother Mike is a chemical engineer. He's working as he is in management at a toilet paper plant in Pennsylvania, where they have like been, you know, hit by the shortage, hit by all kinds of things. But he always has super interesting and super insightful things to say about what's going on there. And you know, it's really hilarious and interesting.
Yeah, it definitely brings a lot of laughs throughout the day.
Yeah.
Seeing what everyone's doing.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's a great way to keep everybody's mental health up and check up on each other. And it's pretty cool. It's a very invaluable thing. And I think that, in our modern society, that is lacking in a lot of ways. And I think that some people missed that even before this. So it's
For sure.
It's pretty fucking cool to be able to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, man. Plus, you know, you could shit post, you know?
Yeah. I won't mention the one picture that was shared today.
I'll never mention it. I always wonder, I'm like, damn, somebody is going to like leak this text message, and I'm going to have to like explain what was said. I'm going to have to.
Not only is that like some text might be a little not safe for work, but then the name of the group text is pretty not safe for work.
Yeah, constantly an evolving way to like a challenge to see if someone looks over your shoulder and sees what you're being texted by to see if they can be offended or not be offended, but like, you know, get a good rise out of somebody. I think we should come up with some kind of will where we posthumously can release it to our grandkids. Maybe redact it a little bit, like a CIA document.
I had a student, like, before I put that thing on silent so it wouldn't just pop up, like, my phone was on my desk, and a junior or a senior, I forget what it was and what grade, like, it went bing, and he saw the name of the group text, and he's like, really? Wow.
Damn. I love it. I love the fact that we're not going to share it either. That's great.
No, it's secret.
But yeah, as far as that that social connection goes, especially in this time of social distancing, which I was talking to your brother today, Social D needs to make a social distancing RIP t-shirt. But he said apparently they did already, so I haven't. I gotta look it up.
That's such a great idea.
Yeah, especially in this time where all I want to do is talk to strangers and hug people, and you can't.
Yeah.
I think we can take advantage of all this technology that we have at hand. It's pretty fucking bad.
Yeah, I woke up this morning and put on a bunch of music that had gang vocals in it.
Yeah.
Just so I can hear everyone together.
Hell yeah. That's amazing. But Val, I think I'm about to ready to wrap it up. Thanks so much for hanging out. And I would love to do this again.
Me. Oh, hey. Anytime.
So all of our podcast ideas that we had that we haven't done was Bob and Tom Trip.
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah.
Which we go to different, like, weird. Pennsylvania is full of these, like, local festivals and things like that. There's a rattlesnake festival, like, an hour from where we're from, where apparently, I might have this wrong, but they go and they catch a bunch of rattlesnakes, then they bring them to a place, and then they put them back, like, after they have the rattlesnake festival. I don't know
what the fuck it is.
It sounds insane.
There's a festival in Hamlin for 1 year where you would pay $5 and you get a sledgehammer and you can just beat up on a car for 5 minutes.
That's incredible.
So this was when we were really young. That was the first place where I met Brianna from Tiger's Jaw. I think I passed her the sledgehammer. She was like 5'1".
Wow. And you just get to hit like a demolition derby car with a sledgehammer.
Yeah. So like everyone's like along the sides, like talking strategy because everyone's trying to get the door off.
Some teamwork like, right there. I back it.
Yeah, so the entire town really came together about how to beat the shit out of this car.
Yeah, they're like, all right, well, we disagree about whose crick runs through whose property, but we're going to get this door off. I don't know why they have Southern draws. They're from basically the New York border.
Or Toyota Camry is really going to get it. Yeah, so there's a lot of festivals we have to go to.
Yeah, we got to do the St. Ubaldo race, which my sister lives on the St. Ubaldo race track.
A crime. I've never been there.
Oh, we gotta go.
I also want my first time to go when we have the podcast set up so we can interview people there. Like, I want to go in with fresh eyes, a fresh lens.
Okay.
And being like, it's my first time there. I want to experience it all. Because when I was working that construction job, I worked in Jessup. And this woman said at her in her basement, they put trash bags on the floor. And they set up all their kegs on top of like lined trash bags on the floor, and they just get like messy.
Oh, we're gone. We gotta go. Yeah. Oh yeah, we should do a history of it. We'll get the historical context. We'll go. Bring the Zoom recorder. That'd be so fucking fun. Basically, it's like a sister city of a city in Italy that does a three statue race. The race is rigged. The same team wins every year. But they like all these groups of like people, right? Of course, they all wear a certain colored neckerchief, and they do this giant run up and down the streets. And it's like an old, you know, coal town. All the houses are right next to each other. It looks a lot like Pittsburgh and the Deer Hunter. And they carry these giant statues, and they run around. And they like put dollars on them, like they did in The Godfather. Yeah. And then have a big fireworks display at the end, and everybody's just eating and having fun.
I can't wait to go.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we gotta go. It's gonna be amazing. So that's where the next episode we're gonna do is gonna be at the St. Ubaldo race.
Live St. Ubaldo race.
By then it's just live. The technology's there. It'd be so sick. But yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks,
love you to death, and I can't wait to do the St. Ubaldo episode. It's gonna be awesome.
Absolutely. Stay tuned.
Hell yeah, thanks, Bob.
All right, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Future Friday. Come join us on May 6th over at Stage It. I say us, but really it's just going to be Bob that's playing. I'm going to be talking shit in the comments and hanging out my friends virtually. That's like 3 p.m. for you maniacs in California, a good 4 p.m. for the hippies in Denver, maybe in Phoenix, depending on whether or not it's daylight savings time. I can never get that one right. 5 p.m. in Chicago and rolling down, and a good 11 o'clock for our folks across the Atlantic. And now here I am just rambling. But yeah, I hope that this podcast finds you in good health and good mind. And if it doesn't, I hope it gets you a little bit closer there. Good luck. Good night.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Mo, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to the show on the road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.